well, well. It's been a little while since we've seen each other. That is Tony Allen from his 2014 album, Film of Life. The song is entitled Moving On. Tony Allen, if you can tell from the rhythm, is better known as one of the pioneers, if not the pioneer, of what we now know as Afrobeat. He was a drummer and now composer as well, who has performed so many years with Fela Anikula Bokuti, and he continues in that tradition even now. This album was released just last year to rave reviews. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, June the 8th, 2015, and a couple of things to catch up with you on. First of all, as you just heard Gary as he signed off, PRN is in its new studios, and that's great, great news. Wonderful progress. More space, I'm told. I haven't seen the studios yet. I guess I'll be up there soon enough. But more space and an increased capability to do a lot of production work and so forth. So this was a wonderful, wonderful piece of news that we finally are at home. One little step to go, which is to get the phones in place, and as Gary says, about 600 boxes unpacked, but it's great progress, and that is a tribute to the support from listeners like you, who for these many years have been keeping PRN really at the center of your knowledge and your thirst for knowledge. So I want to thank you for that, and I also thank you for your patience. It's a big move. It was a huge move. And like anything else, you know, when you really come down to it, the guts of the operation is all wires and technical stuff. And there's no way to hurry that along. You have to take your time and make sure that everything is installed correctly. Then you test it. Then you retest it. And then you're ready to go. So we're almost at that point, and it's a great, great milestone. So thank you so much, and I congratulate all the folks at PRN who have worked like crazy over the past several weeks in trying to get this move accomplished, and many volunteers who also contributed their labor to giving support that we needed to get into the new studio. So that's a wonderful thing. Second, I want to give you a kind of report about myself. So many of you have been wanting to know, and I thank you for your inquiries. Well, I think I'm in good shape. I feel good. I feel great, as a matter of fact, considering all of what I'm saying to you now might have been posthumously delivered. But I did celebrate my 62nd birthday on June the 1st. I actually have two birthdays. I don't take any chances, June 1 and 2, because my mother recorded my birth date on one day. I strongly suspect she was there when I was born, and she recorded my birthday as June the 2nd. And for some reason, in the way things work in the Caribbean, you get a birthday when you show up to register your child. And apparently on the day that they showed up to register me, June 1st was on everybody's mind. So I take no chances. June 1 and 2. I call it my birthday. 1 and 2. Make it one day. The good news is that considering the diagnosis and the prognosis that I shared with you as to where I am at this point, it was a wonderful, wonderful birthday. And I thank you so much, those of you who extended your good wishes and your prayers and your good vibes, and you sent them my way. I received them in the spirit that you sent them. Thank you so much for that. I'm following a very rigorous protocol, and it seems to be working because I feel very good. I'm walking. Well, I have to share this story with you. Now, I thought I was doing really good. I was very impressed with myself until Gary, who was walking very slowly for him, he was walking slowly, lapped me three times. I really resented it. Three times. I said, well, look at that. But of course, the whole thing was about finishing. And the word finishing means for me these days a total of about 24 laps in all, 12 in the morning and 12 in the afternoon, to just get the old lungs working and the body energized. And I'm following a particular protocol with regard to nutrition and boosting the immune system, and of course declaring an all-out war on cancer cells. So that's where I am. But I'm very grateful, and I'm very hopeful, and very blessed to have people who had crossed my paths in different ways, but who at this juncture are crossing my path in a particularly helpful way. And I have no idea what I did to deserve it, but I am so thankful and so grateful that people are gracious and kind and caring about me and are showing a vested interest in my getting better. So I thank you for that, and I want you to know how much it means to me, because as I walk, and as I do go through my rituals, I also invoke your spirits. I call upon you to boost me for the day, and I find that I accomplish the goal. And the goal is I want to, of course, perform at a particular level so that I don't go beneath it. And I stick it through until I'm satisfied I've done the job for the day. So that is such a wonderful thing to be on the receiving end of that. And I wish that we can really just do this, not wait until something serious or disastrous or catastrophic occurs, or that we lose people entirely and then it is too late. We do things, we are then forced to do things post facto. While we are around, this is the time to do it and to really extend ourselves to each other in that spirit. I thank you so very much for that. That's great. I also want to say that I think that, you know, I don't want to be preachy about it. I don't want to, you know, suddenly come across as a person who has seen the light and feel compelled like the ancient mariner to stop you and stop every person I meet and issue a warning. But I do want to make note of something, and that is the need, I think, for us to be a little bit more cognizant of how important it is to be in a state of reasonably good health. In the last several weeks and months, so many people whose paths I crossed and theirs with mine have just gone on. They've passed on. And for reasons, really, that, you know, in the end, they could have stuck around a little longer if a little bit more care were taken. I was discussing with Gary the profiles, the health profiles, especially in the African-American Caribbean communities. In Trinidad, where I come from, where I was born, the health profiles are nothing short of alarming. People are dying like crazy from perfectly preventable diseases. Hypertension, stroke, heart disease, cancer. And I cannot but help think that a lot of it has to do with, and I'm going to get a little bit political here, a lot of it has to do with the Caribbean and other places, developing countries, seen as dumping grounds for all of the garbage that nobody in their right mind would want to eat. And I will do a program about that, because I want you to understand how deliberate this is. This is done deliberately. And these awful foods, this awful way of eating, has kept so many countries absolutely rich, the GDP of many countries alive and thriving, because people in Africa and India and in the Caribbean and in the Far East are eating things that just were thrown at them and that support major sectors of other people's economies. Here's a little something, a little example. In Trinidad, we eat what we call saltfish or codfish, which is dried, salt cured. It has really very little nutritional value by the time it is prepared and reconstituted, because first of all, it's dried, it's salted, it's dried again and salted again. And that was a process that was invented to keep codfish viable, so that sailors in the old colonial and imperialist days, this could be part of their meal. It would last. So the Caribbean, all of which was colonized, whether by France or Spain or Britain or Holland or Portugal or you name it, they brought all this junk into the Caribbean because, of course, by then they felt, well, as long as we keep the slaves minimally fed with something, and then after slavery, they kept the tradition going. Now slaves have to pay for the crappy foods that were given us to eat and that have become part of our cultural profile. Codfish is one of those things. Now, as you know, it's a tropical country. We've never eaten cod. Not a single cod swam through Caribbean waters. And do you know, to this day, codfish is sold at a price per pound that is perhaps three, if not four times higher than really good fresh fish. And yet, there is this proclivity toward codfish. So, but this one meal, this one dish, this one food-like substance has kept Portugal alive, has kept Spain alive, has kept many countries that provide these awful throwaway pieces of cod, salted, salt-cured codfish alive. And the downside is the people who are consuming this stuff are dying like flies. Great irony, but this is where we are. So I wish somehow, and I'll do my little part to just get people into thinking and rethinking the nutritional value of the things that they buy. And it's really very, very important. So I'm grateful. Thank you so much. All right, enough of this. Let's move on. The headlines in the last couple of days have underscored a point that I have made time and again on this program, and that is the value of the lives of African people in this country and how we how we get to learn about the value. We get to learn about the value as a result of mostly disasters, life-taking disasters. We learn about the need for police reform literally after hundreds and hundreds of people, most of them people of color, have just been shot dead or in other ways taken out by members of the police departments of different cities. And the cry for reform does not, in fact, erase the deaths at all, does it? But we are encouraged to think about the fact that somebody wants reform. It's about time that we have some reform. But we never talk about the fact that this discussion is predicated on the killings of people of color, predominantly across the board, across this country. We have time and again come back to the subject, and we see we have no choice but to believe. I did a piece on the fact that we need to have a kind of public declaration of no confidence in the Justice Department or in the criminal justice system. We should have such a thing, and we should have all of these aspirants to the presidency of the United States. They ought to be questioned very closely about what it is they stand for. People are crawling out of the woodwork, people like Rudolph Giuliani, who is proof positive that the worst elements of our society have ended up at the helm of administration. You know, here's a man who is trying to gain some kind of traction on the idea that he was Mr. Law and Order. You know, Rudolph Giuliani was the epitome of anti-crime. He was an abomination. He was an insult. A racist insult, because under his stewardship, New York City sank even lower into an abyss, a racist abyss, again predicated on the assumption that all of these high-minded theories will be tested on you-know-who, African-Americans and Latinos. That was Rudolph Giuliani's claim to fame. And here you have a very mediocre guy with a very mediocre history as a so-called prosecutor. Many of his cases, in fact, were reversed because the lawyering was just so poor and so twisted. But never mind that. If you have enough money to sink into a good public relations campaign, you too can emerge as a savior of the city. And you appear on these shows and you wax philosophic because somehow you supposedly have a great deal more knowledge than anybody else about this particular subject. Well, Giuliani does know something about crime. His father was a mob enforcer. So he ought to know something about crime. I suspect he knows a thing or two about crime. But when we look at the implementation of policy under Rudolph Giuliani, what do we see? We see a very scary pattern. And by the way, it is as if it went on steroids. This rash of killings all across the country and people finding all kinds of ways to excuse and absolve the cops from these killings, it's all predicated on the unexpressed racism in this country that, yes, we, you know, it shouldn't have gone that way, but in as much as it did, it just shows that we need some reforms. The person or persons dead, just dead. And then it becomes a matter of, it's a clinical exercise. It has no human impact, no human dimension to it. It is an administrative opportunity to fix things. At some point, I don't know when that point is. I thought we would have reached it by now if we were able to put together the profiles that have presented themselves to us, the records, the so-called reports by all these different agencies whose directors and heads are making so much money as administrators, and yet we have the same kind of experience all across the country. So we should have no trouble by now coming to certain conclusions. If a thing happens over and over and over again, producing exactly the same kind of result, it is reasonable to conclude that these things are not just flashes in the pan. These things are systemic. These things are now statistically to be interpreted as fact. These are facts now. Statistically, we can say at this point in our history as a country that African Americans, Latinos in particular, Native Americans, these are targeted populations. We are living in an apartheid state. We are living in a police state. These things we can say with some degree of authority. People will say, well, you're generalizing. I beg to differ. The facts are there. The facts are saying that the problem not only is systemic, but it has not gone away. So what are people to do? I will put something to you that may sound a little bit alarmist, but I really don't mean it to be alarmist. I'm saying this from, again, assessing what the facts have been and what the facts still are. Tied into this whole thing about police brutality, and I don't even like using the word brutality. It sounds too tidy. These are murders. These are really out of control, psychotic cops. But these are police officers who are operating within a framework that has long been acceptable in the United States. And in fact, I'll even go further to say that that framework is the framework, the social, political, and economic framework of the United States. There are people who are powerful and there are people who are not. We talked at length on this program about the zero-sum, primitive way of thinking. Where we are now, the wealthy can feel and continue to feel wealthy only if they can also see the flip side, that there are people who are not. The people who are powerful will feel satisfied only when you can see pervasive evidence that there are people who are not. The people who have become accustomed to this idea of entitlement and white supremacy can only feel comfortable when they see that others cannot feel that way. That a system sees to it that we have these bifurcations, these zero-sum ways of operating. It is not enough that I should have. It is important that you should not have. So what does the country do? A state like Florida, for example, where people are poor and can't afford to buy food and pay their rents and just subsist. The first thing they want to do is go cut social services, because that makes the rich and powerful feel even more secure. We have the power to make other people feel tremendously insecure. And there's a certain mentality that pervades all the way across all these different realms that we cross every single day. This notion that you take comfort, your sense of security, your sense of comfort, your sense of entitlement, your sense of superiority requires the polar opposite in groups of people. And if you look at the tenor of our times, you see more and more evidence that groups of people, certain groups of people, literally are suffering, literally are being targeted. It's not unlike Europe, when an awful human being named Adolf Hitler came to power. How, a very average guy, but not at all average in terms of his psychosis, not at all average in terms of his ambition, not at all average in terms of his delusional idea that basically he was ordained divinely to rule the world. In a fair world, nobody would even have known his name. But in a society that subscribes to these notions that our security requires other people's insecurity, our sense of comfort requires other people's gross discomfort, our wealth requires extreme poverty in others. And you see the same trend in all of these fascistic societies, racist societies in South Africa, where a handful of Boers, a handful, supported by like-minded crazies, subjugated an entire nation for so long, still, and they're still doing it, creating the sense that we are powerful, we are safe, we are superior, only when we can demonstrate that we have the other people, the vast majority of the other people, in check. And that's how I interpret this spate of police killings. It is an extension of this thinking in the United States that there is a system, there's an apparatus of control that works not only for itself, because that's what a police state does, but it undergirds, it shores up the wider view, the wider thinking, that this is the way it has to be if we are going to maintain ourselves. And you find very liberal people thinking this way. You find progressives thinking this way, or at least people who say they are. You find fair-minded people going down this route, which is why increasingly you feel more and more alone. African Americans and Latinos are feeling more and more alone and more isolated, because all the good people, all the good voices, all the righteous people, the fair-minded people, are hiding. Because in some significant way, they understand themselves to be beneficiaries of the system, and they don't mind it. if they had a choice to side with the underprivileged or unprivileged, or to side with the privileged, well, where else would they go? It's a logical choice. Would I give up the bennies that I have in this society, the way it is constructed, where simply by having white skin, I have so much more available to me, so much more opportunity, so much more possibility for the good life? Why would I want to give that up? So you see, this is a very deep thing. It's not just about, we look at these statistics, we look at what the statistics are telling us, what these lost lives are supposed to be telling us. They're supposed to be telling us to be angry. They're supposed to be telling us it's time to declare our own kind of war. We ought to be publicly denouncing the system. We ought to be publicly opposing it. We ought to be publicly standing up for people who clearly cannot stand up for themselves. They are dead. And if you understand anything about, well, back in all sociology, you learn about systems theory. Systems theory is very simple. It means that each of us, in one way or the other, belongs in a system. The system could be your family. It could be your co-workers. Your system could be a church. Your system could be a block association. But we are byproducts of systems. And many of us are within systems, many different systems, every single day. So when you dislodge one part of a system, you really are dislodging and you're shaking up all these other systems. So I want to put it this way to you. When someone is killed, it is not just the immediate family that hurts. It's all of the systems in which that individual participated and traversed. All these systems are shaken up. If you were to multiply based on the numbers of deaths of young, mostly young Black and Latino men, if you were to see the rippling effect of that, and then you tell me, well, we are studying what we can do, or we think, you know, we don't know yet what the impact is, or you decide that the impact only goes this far. It doesn't go beyond that. There's just, you know, one or two things, the family, of course, and, you know, we'll show the family grieving, and that's about it. It's just a family. That this person who no longer exists doesn't have a series of systems that are affected or that will in the future be affected simply by his or her absence. That's how we're supposed to think. We are supposed to have arrived at a point where we see things differently. And we cannot go along with the standard definition of things because it is insufficient and deliberately so. Because in the United States, everything is brought to its lowest common denominator and its smallest dimension, especially when it relates to people who are members of oppressed classes. Yes, we're sorry that you're dead, but, you know, really, how far were you going to go anyway? You know what I mean? That's how we are taught to think about ourselves. We are taught to perceive ourselves this way as individuals and as a society, and that we're supposed to accept it. It is completely unacceptable that with all of this money, billions and billions and billions, if not trillions of dollars spent on this thing called law enforcement and criminal justice, that we have this horrible state of affairs across the board. And the reason it is acceptable, the only reason that it is acceptable, is that the system is producing the desired results, containing the bacteria, making sure that we have a clear-cut division between the powerful and the powerless, between black and white and Latino, between rich and poor. The system is working just fine. I was talking with a fellow reporter over the weekend about cases we have covered in New York City. Spectacular cases which got very little coverage, very little coverage comparatively in major media, but were huge in their implications with respect to the African American and Latino communities. And this goes back to the 70s. Cases that showed rampant abuse of power within the police department and all the way to the top. Cases in which young people who had nothing to do with the crime that they were charged with were charged nonetheless with a crime because a detective could get a collar and a prosecutor could get a notch on his or her belt. And they knew that the person or persons were not at all connected. They know that. The judges know it. The prosecutors know it. They all know it. But these are dispensable people. Nobody's going to cry out for them. Nobody is going to advocate for them. Nobody is going to miss them if they should just be taken out of circulation one way or the other, either by jail or by bullet, police bullet. So we have decades and decades and decades of that. And we reached a point where you have an African-American U.S. Attorney General followed by another African-American U.S. Attorney General. And this would be the last thing on the agenda. Actual justice. Why? Because these populations are part of the GDP of this country. The criminal justice system is very much a part of the GDP. And if you are going to have to feed a system with bodies so that it can continue to be part of the GDP, then you look to those populations that are of no consequence. And it is not accidental that the prison populations uniformly across the board in the United States are black and brown. Of course, there are whites as well. But we see the trend, and we can't deny it, that this is, if we see overwhelming statistical proof, and on a consistent basis, that these realities do in fact persist, you would have to be crazy to dismiss this as fact. They therefore are facts. So I'm saying the time has come, long gone actually, for us to stop playing around and pretending that there is something else. It can't possibly be what we are seeing. It can't possibly be what we know. That there's a need for more studying. There's a need for more analysis. There's a need for more reports and more panel discussions and more testimony and all of this kind of stuff. No, there's enough of that. There's enough. And so people should take the position, we don't need anything more to persuade us of an alternative, an alternate reality. We are satisfied given the vast volumes of information and statistics and reports that we have, that it is time to come to some conclusive truths and to be comfortable with those truths because they backed up statistically. They backed up also experientially. They backed up by reality. Truth one, we are an apartheid country. That was said a long time ago. We know that. We have the proof. There's no need to continue the discussion as if we still are exploring the possibility of a different answer. Black men, Latino men in particular, these groups dominate because they dominate as the people targeted. We should accept and we should declare that they are targeted groups. I wouldn't worry about the psychological fallout. Well, what would you do if you tell your child that he's, you know, should be afraid of police? You'd be crazy to not tell your child, given where people are living and how they're living. That is now a necessary thing to apprise a child about. This is a part of the political reality, political and social reality. A 12-year-old kid, the cop didn't even give him 5 seconds of doubt. Kills him, shot him dead, Tamir Rice. So we should not play around with these games configurations and go through more lengthy discussions. We should come to the conclusion, we have had all the discussions that we need. We don't need any more. So we should conclude that African-American men, Latino men, by virtue of the statistics, should understand themselves to be targeted, a targeted class. If you don't accept that, then you're not dealing with reality, as it seems to me. We should understand how this country operates, the zero-sum way of thinking, that the exact opposite will therefore make everything even. If I'm ridiculously rich, we got to have ridiculously poor people because that evens everything out. And it therefore undergirds what we call social policy. And then they could start talking, well, we should all pay taxes and the same taxes, and you know, as if that has ever happened. We keep indulging in these fantasies. We distort our reality all the time. We keep going to the same people whose job it is to deny justice, asking for justice, and expecting somehow, some kind of a beam of light will penetrate the clouds and bring some new understanding to these folks so that they would operate differently. It's not going to happen. It is time to reconcile this. It's time to accept this as a reality. There is not going to be any reformation. There is not going to be any what is the word, reform of any sort. That's not going to be anything. At best, what you will get is a palliative. You'll get a little something here, and it's going to be not worth very much anyway. It's not going to have any teeth to it. It's not going to exact any consequence for those people who do the wrong. It's not going to happen. And this we must accept. We don't have to like it, of course. When I say accept it, I don't mean you just lay down and let it happen. I mean accept it in terms of being a part of your consciousness. Every single day, you ought to be conscious that this is more than likely what the structure is that you're working with. And then you begin the process of articulating something different, but based first on the recognition of the reality that you're dealing with. Now, when I received a devastating diagnosis, I could have just, you know, said, oh my gosh, you know, and throw my hands up in the air. That's not going to be me at all. I'm going fighting. My reality is something entirely different from the reality I am told I ought to have, the mindset I am told I ought to have. And so if I had yielded, I would have been dead already. If I had succumbed to the all-knowing expert physicians, I would have been dead already. In fact, they told me, go home and make yourself as comfortable as possible. That was their diagnosis and prognosis. But you have to construct based on a careful examination of what it is you're dealing with. You have to construct a reasonable alternative that you can implement yourself. Don't leave it to them. They already have squandered any legitimacy in your eyes. You can't look to them for direction and guidance. That's not what they're there for. They're not there to guide you and to direct your way and to direct your path toward health or toward success or toward it. That's not what they're there for. Of course, you will have one or two or three or four exceptions, but the vast majority of people are in lockstep with what the system tells them they ought to be doing and thinking. Now, if you are so delusional that you would actually believe that these same people are going to fashion a way to liberate you, then I suggest you sign up right away for some intensive psychiatric counseling, because you're nuts. You're going to see these people from the NAACP and the Urban League and people like Sharpton and others go knocking on the doors. Oh, we want an investigation. They know very well there isn't going to be one. And if there is one, it's not going to be credible. It's not going to yield a result. We on this program, Alton Maddox and myself, we told you how these things are going to happen. We were right to the absolute nth degree. Not because there's some great, extraordinary brilliance happening there. Well, in my case, yes, and in Alton's case, yes. But because statistics, that's all you have, history and statistics, prepared us to tell you what is going to happen. It wasn't guessing. History and statistics told you exactly what was going to happen, what they were going to do, what they were going to say, what the tactics will be. But you have those people who are disillusioned, these leaders, who are knocking on the same doors that were shut to all of us, saying, look, you guys, you just don't get it. We are in control here. We have our system. What you want is not only not possible, it ain't going to happen. We're not going to make it happen because it will eat away at all of the little pillars that we have put in place to assure our supremacy in this country. And that we value. We value supremacy. Now, do you think we would do something to undermine our supremacy? Are you insane? So, I know I rambled a little bit today, but really, if you look at it, there are threads here. What I'm trying to tell you is, it's time to stop playing games. Don't let them continue to play games with you and your mind. You see the reality. And you therefore should operate accordingly. The system is not to be trusted. Now, people would say that that is kind of rather cynical. Well, I would say, if that's your view that it's cynical, then maybe you have dismissed the facts, the statistics, the history that fully supports a rational approach being to be cynical of the system. What I want to encourage is that we don't focus on the system anymore. It is a known entity. Focus on what you can do, or how you have to prepare yourself and those who are important to you and your communities. How do you prepare yourself to deal with the system in as much as this is how it is organized, how it is designed, and how it operates, and how it likely will continue to do so? That's all. Never mind them. These are proven entities. We have the goods on them. The question comes back to the frequently asked question here on this program. What is your response? What is to be the answer? And what will that answer be? I want to thank you so much for listening to me today and allowing me to stretch out a little bit and talk in a way that I very seldom get to talk, but I felt a need to say it, because in the period that we were making the transition to our new studios, we saw so many headlines pointing this up in dramatic ways, this theme in dramatic ways, that we can't continue this sick cycle of extending credibility and extending the benefit of the doubt to a system that does not deserve it, but that we should also concentrate on designing and fixing an alternative. That's what we ought to be doing. Stay tuned. Keep it right here on PRN for more great programming coming up. And I just want to remind you, this week, we are not able to take your calls, which is going to be remedied very shortly as the phone lines are installed and tested and retested. The main thing is that PRN has accomplished a great goal of moving into a fantastic space that allows us to stretch out and do even better programming and more programming for you. And it's just a little hop, skip, and jump again to the finish line. And we will, of course, be with each other. So this week, as soon as we know that the lines are working, we will open them up. As you know, this is my thing. I love talking with you. But to wrap up, I want to thank you once again for all of your kind thoughts and your good wishes. I value them, and I will lean on them to pull me through. Thanks so much. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. You did listen.
listen to my music. Make you listen to my music. I don't do many, many noise, but make you listen. Because music will...